Welcome to Bookman, where you can take a pause and dive into the wide world of literature. I'm Julie Nguyen, and today I'll be reading the first chapter of The Hazelwood by Melissa Albert for First Chapter Friday. Before we begin, we must give a disclaimer to say the views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and not those of the Bend School District. This episode may include spoilers, so please listen at your own risk. Also, I will be saying Sandy's name wrong, so please forgive me and be gracious with me here. Chapter 1. Adaya Proserpine is raising her daughter on fairy tales. Once upon a time, she was a girl named Anna Parks, one of the legion of mid-century dreamers who came to Manhattan with her hopes tucked into a suitcase. Then she went missing. Then she came back and achieved all kind of fame, glittering from some angles but dark from others. Now she is gone again, fled to a turreted house in the deep dark woods, where she lives with her 5-year-old daughter and her husband, an actual royal. She just can't quit fairy tales. When I get her on the phone, her voice is as alluring as her most famous photo. The one with the ring and the cigarette. As if I can come talk to her in person, and her laugh is hot, whiskey on ice. You get lost in a way to find me, she says. You need breadcrumbs, not or a spoiled thread. The Queen of the Hinterland, Vanity Fair, 1887. My mother was raised on fairy tales, but I was raised on highways. My first memory is the smell of hot pavement and a sky through the sunroof, woven by in a river of blue. My mom tells me that's impossible. Our car doesn't have a sunroof. But I can still close my eyes and see it, so I'm holding on to it. We crossed the country 100 times in our beater car that smells like french fries and stale coffee and plasticky strawberries. From the day I fed my Tinkerbell lipstick into the slats of the heater vent. We stayed in so many places with so many people that I never really learned the concept of stranger danger. Which is why when I was 6 years old, I got into an old blue book with a red-headed man I've never seen and drove him for 14 hours straight, plus 2 stops for bathroom breaks and 1 for pancakes, before the cops pulled us over, tipped off by a waitress who recognized my description from the radio. By then, I figured the man wasn't who he said he was, a friend of my grandmother, Adia, taking me to see her. Adia was already secluded in her big house then, and I never met her. She had no friends, just fans. And my mother told me that's what the man was, a fan who wanted to use me to get to my grandma. After they determined I had been assaulted, after the red-headed man was identified as a drifter who stole in a car a few miles from the place we were staying in Utah, my mother said we'd never talk about it again. She didn't want to hear it when I told her the man was kind, that he told me stories and had a warm laugh that made me believe, deep in my 6-year-old heart, he was such a my father come to claim me. She's been shown the red-headed man in custody through a one-way mirror and swore she'd never seen him before. For a few years, I persisted in believing he was my dad. When we left Utah after his arrest to live for a few months in an artist retreat outside of Tempe, I worried he wouldn't be able to find me again. He never did. By the time I turned 9, I recognized my secret belief for what it was, a child's fantasy. I felt away like I did all the things I didn't need. Old toys, bedtime superstitions, clothes I didn't fit. My mom and I lived like vagrants, staying with friends who are a welcome wardrobe at the elbows, perching in precarious places, then moving on. We didn't have the luxury of being nostalgic. We didn't have a chance to stand still until the year I turned 17 and Athea died in the Hazelwood. When my mother, Ella, got the letter, a shudder ran through her. That was before she opened it. The envelope was creamy green and printed with her name and the address of the place we were staying. We arrived the night before, and I wonder how it found us. She found an ivory letter opener from the table beside her because we were housing for the kind of people who kept bits of murdered elephants around for show. With shaking hands, she slid the envelope jaggedly through its middle. Her nail polish was so red, it looked like she cut herself. As she shook it out, the letter caught the light, so I couldn't see the blocks of black text through the back, but couldn't read them. Ella made a sound I didn't recognize, a gasp of complicated pain that cut my breath off clean. She held the paper so close to her face that colored her skin a faint silver green, her mouth moving as she redrew again. Then she crumpled the letter up and tossed it into the trash. We weren't supposed to smoke inside that place, a cramped apartment on a New York Upper West Side that smelled like expensive French soap and wet Yorkies, but Ella pulled a cigarette out anyway, and lit off an anti-crystal lighter. She sucked in smoke like it was a milkshake, tapping the fingers of one hand against the heavy green stone she wore at the pulse of her throat. My mother's dead, she said on an exhale, and coughed. The news hit me like a death charge, a knot of pain in my stomach that kept expanding. But it had been a long time since I spent my hours dreaming of Athia. The news shouldn't have hurt me at all. Ella squatted down in front of me, put her hands on my knees. Her eyes were shiny but dry. This isn't a bad thing. It's not. It could change things for us. It could... Her voice cracked in half before she could finish. She put her head down on my knees and sobbed once. It was a desolate sound that belonged somewhere else. Out there were dark roads and deadly smell, not in this bright room in the middle of a loud, bright city. When I kissed the crown of her hair, it smelled like diner coffee and the smoke churning up from her cigarette. She breathed in, out, and turned her face up to look at me. Do you know what this means for us? I said to her, then around the room we were sitting in, rich and stuffy and somebody else. Wait, does this mean we get to Hazelwood? My grandmother's estate, which I only seen in photos, felt like a place I remember from some alternate imaginary childhood. One where I rode horses and went to summer camp. It was a daydream I disappeared into when I needed a break from the endless cycles of highways and new schools and the smell of unfamiliar houses. I paced myself into the distant world of fountains and hedges, high poles and a pole so glaring, bright you had to squint against it. But my mother's bony hand was around my wrist, pulling me out of the technicolor lawns of the Hazelwood. God, no. Never. It means we're free. Free of what? I asked stupidly. But she didn't answer. She stood, tossing her half-smoked cigarette into the trash, right onto the letter, walked straight back out of the room, like there was something she had to do. When she was gone, I poured cold coffee on the trash can fire and pulled out the wet letter. Parts of it were eaten into ash, but I found the soggy reminder against my knees. The type was as dense in all space as a text on an old telegram. The letter didn't seem new, it even smelled like it had been sent from the past. I could imagine someone typing it up on an old electric, like the one in front of Quaz's Sagan postcard hung over my bed in every place we stayed. I breathed in its scent of ash and powdered perfume as I scanned what was left. There wasn't much of it. We send our condolences, and come at your earliest. One maroon word in a sea of singed paper, Alice. My name. I couldn't read anything that came before or after it. I saw no other reference to myself. I dropped the wet mess into the trash. This has been Julie Wimmel Bookmark. We hope you enjoyed this episode. We'll catch you again next week. Our music is by Fezzoline Studio. Thank you.